Wealth doesn't just happen. You have to go after it and build it. And the chase can be packed with thrills, frustration, and adventure. Join hosts Chris on a journey into mortgage notes, a little known but fascinating type of real estate investing that's full of human drama and perfect for growing your IRA or savings. We build wealth by working with distressed borrowers who are fighting to keep their homes, and that's why we call it Good Deeds Note Investing. We're doing good and making money. Join us.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Good Deeds Note Investing Podcast, where we share our stories on the snitch industry of mortgage note investing as part of a real estate investment strategy. I am your host, Chris Seveny, along with my special guest host, Jamie Bateman. Jamie, how are you today?
Doing great, Chris. Happy to be here.
Yes, happy to be here as well. I think most of us woke up this morning with some interesting news in the world. You know, we do not talk politics.
Saw that.
Yeah, we don't talk politics, but I still think it should be worth noting. You know, we found out this morning the president did come down with coronavirus, and it's October, and we want to talk about some frightening things. And this is frightening in the sense of how markets and everything is going to react based on this. So kind of just want to mention that as part of our intro and part of our trials and tribulations. And with that, Jamie, what are some of the things that you have for people to share as part of either a story or something frightening since we're in October?
Yeah, since we're in October, I was going to discuss a scary story in a financially scary story that we experienced a few years back. And this has to do with a rental property that we own. So it's not really a note story, but it was 2015. My wife and I, we'd had one rental for about 5 or 6 years, but frankly, it's a condo and it's talked about it before. It's pretty low maintenance. So I didn't really count that. So this rental property that we purchased with our second was truly the first one that I still consider the first real rental property, in the sense that we decided to take our rental property business, buy and hold business, to the next level, take it seriously. So this is the first one of these properties of several that we plan to buy and get into kind of actively. So we buy this property, find a tenant who was highly qualified. She was an attorney, and it's around this time of year, around September, October timeframe. And everything was great. She was excited to move in. We were all set up with, we do most of our rent collection through Cozy. And she was fine with that at first. And then all of a sudden, I started seeing some kind of issues where she had some, I guess, lack of progress with moving in, put it that way. She didn't want to pay online because Cozy didn't have a customer service line. So you know, I found this other online service we could collect rent through. But that seemed a little bit odd to me that hadn't been an issue before and now it was. And then all of a sudden, she wanted to pay by check. And so she hadn't moved in yet, but I was already starting to see some issues. But we move forward. She has a list of things she wanted us to fix up, a few things, you know, before she moved in, and us being brand new to the rental business, we're fixing everything we possibly can. And when she says jump, we say how high, that kind of thing. So she moves in, I guess, and all of a sudden she just goes dark. And trying to get feedback on, does she like the house? Is she happy with what we fixed up and that kind of thing? And she does not respond. So she ends up lawyering up herself. Like I said, she's an attorney. And out of nowhere, we get contacted by an attorney saying that we need to start collecting our insurance paperwork because she's sick from being exposed to COVID, but airborne contaminants.
Mold or formaldehyde or something.
Exactly. So finally, I did get a response from her, and with a lawyer-esque type email, I'll say, with all these things she wanted done and how she's been completely sick. Bottom line is she wanted out and she changed her mind for some other personal reason. And this is my opinion. She changed her mind after having fixed up, gotten the place ready to move in. And so she starts threatening to sue, and all communication is going through her attorney. We're supposed to be gathering our insurance paperwork. Mind you, we're pretty new to this game at this point. So not that I'd welcome this to happen again, but I'd feel a little more well-prepared and comfortable if it did. And we're kind of freaking out. And mind you, again, I kind of talked my wife into hopping on board with this rental property train. And so we're freaking out. I mean, are we going to get sued? We have two attorneys coming after us, let alone we're heading into the fall season, which is a terrible time to try to rent a property. At least it's not ideal around here. So I spoke with several different attorneys. One is my friend in New York, who I mentioned last week, actually. And he said, why don't you do a release, have her sign a release, that essentially we can't talk specifics about what happened and we'll agree not to sue each other. So end of the day, it was a scary story for sure. This is our foray into buy and hold real estate. We're about to get sued right out of the gate. End of the day, we lost about 2 months rent. I did negotiate a little bit, got her down some. We let her go. All the legal advice we received was, hey, just be thankful she's not your tenant. And funny thing is, I spoke with another former boss of mine who's an attorney and a real estate investor, commercial, residential. And he said, I never rent to attorneys. He said, I won't even rent to a law student. So this is obviously not legal advice. I'm not suggesting you rule out renting to attorneys, but it might be something to consider. So all in all, could have been a lot worse, but it was definitely a scary story as far as what could have happened to us.
Yeah, I've been involved. So I've had an issue with a tenant like that. And the benefit of it being a rental is typically in cases like that, you just say, move out. We won't charge anything, move out. And that basically, in talking with Brian, our attorney we love, he mentions basically, you know, give them that option. Then they can't come after you for money or damages because you give them the option to move. And even if you paid for their move, it's like, if you don't think it's healthy, why are you still living there? And give you an idea, I was involved in a condo lawsuit with similar issue. I had to give a 12-hour deposition. So this was a multi-million dollar lawsuit. I was basically the key person involved in it because I was managing the project and it was stressful. I mean, the attorney's fees on this one were 7-8 digits, I think probably is where they ended up. I know they're at least 7. They probably ended up on 8, give you an idea. So my scary story, yeah. So, and it's interesting because as you go through these life experiences, and this is one of the things in note investing that I think is really key is, and I mentioned this in a prior episode, that first time you get like a letter from like some opposing attorney or from a city or a county that you have a violation or they're going to charge you with a misdemeanor and stuff, you like freak out. And it's like, then once you get through a few of them, you know, it's like falling on a bike. It's like, okay, you know, get up and go to the next one. Perfect example is for my scary story this week, I had a house burn down. And I just was like, I mean, most people would be flipping out. I kind of took it like, you know, like it's raining outside, like, okay, you know, type thing. And, you know, because the reality is, what else am I going to do? So it was, and this is actually a pretty interesting story because I spoke with the fire department. And the interesting thing was, I had already spoken to them about seeing if they would do a controlled burn on this. And they're like, oh, we don't do this. And the guy actually laughed. He goes, well, you got your controlled burn, because I literally spoke to him about 2 weeks ago. So it was a foreclosure. And I posted some of the pictures online. This was the one that had, I mean, so much trash in it. It was, you couldn't walk into the bathroom or kitchen. I don't know how these people were living. Right. But they were also involved in some illegal substances. And when they got evicted, they had a trailer that they literally moved to the lot next door that they didn't even own. And they were living on that trailer. And the fire department, the fire chief mentioned that, I think last week, somebody burned down their trailer. And I'm like, oh, I wish I kind of would have known that because I probably could have witnessed this. And my guess is they probably may have owed somebody something or who knows what. Fun to speculate sometimes. So
yeah, but things like that usually aren't random, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Somehow somebody randomly burns down your trailer only to randomly burn down the house they're living in 3 days later. So got burned down. And I mean, I was listing this thing for, give you an idea, I was listing it for $12,000 to sell. And really, it was the values in the land. It's on a river, but it's, you know, in a floodplain. And I had it under agreement with a seller for $7,500 or something along those lines. It was an REO that I had foreclosed on. So,
okay,
and
I
think I paid like $500 for the note. I mean, I wasn't in it for a lot. All in, I'm probably in it for, I'd have to check, maybe $4,000 or $5,000. So got under agreement, $7,500. A guy from California burns down. He's like, great. And I'm thinking maybe I should raise the price. From that perspective, but we didn't. And, you know, I let the attorney know and the fire department was basically, you know, explaining kind of what happened and stuff. And from an insurance perspective, I did have insurance on it, but I didn't have a lot on it. And, you know, I don't even know if it's worth getting the claim. I have to talk to my insurance side of things. You know, if I would have done the $90 a square foot, then that would have been a, whew, you know, what you should do. And that would have been
nice payday.
Yeah, nice payday. But I had insured it for, I think, pretty much what it was worth. So it wasn't significant from that perspective.
Well, let me ask you real quick, Chris. Okay. I was just curious, how do you approach FPI if it's in general on your deals? I know some investors get FPI for the amount they're into it for, period, and that's it. Does it vary based on the deal, or how do you approach the level of FPI that you get?
That's a great question, and it's something I'm evaluating now, because typically I would do it on what the UPB is, or you know, typically the lesser of the UPB or the value. But I've been talking with our insurance carrier, we use JB Lloyd, and typically if you don't do the $90 a square foot, it gets adjusted on what your claim can be. And one of the things that has me thinking as well, and this is food for thought, is especially on performing loans, the house is worth, I think it's a $90 a square foot, it's a 1,000 square foot house. Why not insure it for $90,000? Because the borrower's paying that bill, especially on a performing asset. And why underinsure it? Now on non-performing, you know, typically that does come out of your pocket, but on the same token, it's probably also higher risk sometimes. So that's a great question. Something I'm evaluating right now. And by the end of the year, I'm going to put together for myself a kind of, I call it a corporate insurance plan of what I'm going to define, how I'm going to treat every deal and come up and basically, this is how I'm going to do it. When you think about running your business like a company, you should come up with corporate policy. And I'm going to come up with a new policy because I've been doing, like you said, I've been kind of doing this and that and everything else. And now that kind of something happened, it's like, okay, I need to come up with something that is very definitive.
I can relate to that. We've been a little bit all over the map with the amount that we get first place insurance.
And it's one of those things people forget about. It's like, oh, and one of the things people will also forget about is your servicer. You may get it through your servicer, but the moment that gets deboarded and foreclosed upon, you better get insurance on it. Thankfully, in this one, I had it all the time under my entity, didn't have it with the servicer, but something that I know some people in the past have forgotten to do and have paid dearly for it. And one thing I've also heard, and we can have a whole another episode on this, is making sure that the place is secure with like smoke detectors and other things like that, because that could void a claim. So just food for thought that we'll have a whole another episode later on down the line on first place insurance.
A lot to talk about there.
Yeah. So let's roll into our main segment we want to talk about today, which is, drumroll please, Jamie. Oh, I was going to have you talk about the main topic, which is...
Oh, sorry.
No problem. Yeah. I actually have little buttons that I need to do the drum roll. I go a little nuts sometimes and buy all these toys and haven't used them yet. But go ahead. What are we talking about today?
So we were going to talk about whether we should be buying, in general, whether note investors should be approaching the market buying non-performers or performers, and given market conditions and different things. So what's the best approach right now for buying notes?
Since I have the seniority over you, I'm going to have you go first.
Nice. So we'll get to what you've been doing, which I think is more non-performers. I do think we're going to start pivoting that way, primarily based on market conditions. Nobody knows. This has been a very strange year in general. I mean, across the board, in many ways, 2020 has been very odd. So no one really knows what's going to happen to real estate or notes or anything like that. But I would guess probably going to be some more non-performers here in the next 6 to 12 months. So I do think that's probably the way to go. And I think if you're already buying non-performers, you've mitigated a lot of that risk. So one of the risks with performers is that it can go non-performing and then you just overpaid for a non-performing note. So a lot of people approach the note business if they're brand new, you know, saying performers are not risky and non-performers are risky. Well, I mean, just like everything else in this business and in life, there's way more nuance to it. It's not that black and white. So if you pay 80 to 90 cents on the dollar and the loan goes non-performing, that's not good. So what we have been doing recently, personally, with our business is we actually have been buying more performers this year, but I will say that's probably more based on our own business model. And we've been selling a lot of partials this year. And partials obviously work considerably better with performing notes. And if I sell a partial, I like to go out and buy another strong performer. The performers we have been buying are very equity protected. This is one difference from maybe last year. We may have been buying performing notes that, or CFDs that have less equity. Well, now the performers I've been buying are more equity protected. The yield's lower for sure, which makes sense. And we can talk about the pricing of notes as well. But I do think just given market conditions, where I think everything is headed, we're going to start heading more toward the non-performing space. One thing I just want to make sure I do say in general for everybody, don't only consider market conditions. I mean, definitely consider your experience level, your goals, your business model. There are a lot of factors besides just the pricing of notes or where we're headed in the marketplace. But those are my initial thoughts.
Yeah. And I agree with a lot. One thing you also have to focus in and kind of as part of this conversation is the pricing of the asset. And that's where I've been leaning more towards on the non-performing. And the reason why is just the performing assets. I'm seeing people list CFDs for 95, 98 cents on the dollar. And I'm sitting there scratching my head like, and they're getting like an eight.
Crazy.
Yeah, it's an 8 or 9% return. And to me, there's not a lot of the house needs work. There's not a lot of equity in it. And like you said, most people that I find do not know how to measure risk. People just plug numbers into a calculator and say, great, here's what I can get for 12%. And, you know, I see posts on, I think it was Bigger Pockets the other day, where I see somebody saying, hey, I'm so close to buying a note, but I don't have a calculator. You know, will somebody share a calculator? And I'm sitting there scratching my head, like, there's more to just the calculator. You need to understand a calculator is garbage in, garbage out. It's only as good as the data you put in. And the moment you put it in, it's wrong. I mean, have you ever had a deal go exactly as you put it in your calculator?
No, not at all.
Yeah. So I always recommend somebody starting out, buy a performing loan that has had a consistent pay history for several years that is secured by equity. And I stand by that. Mm-hmm. And I tell people that's what you want to do. But in the same token, if somebody's trying to sell it at par, then as an experienced investor, that's not my cup of tea. For somebody newer, that's something you'll want to look at. But you still got to be careful, because paying 95, 98 cents on the dollar, you know, when you're looking at $20,000, $30,000 assets, that can get expensive pretty quick if that goes non-performing. And I'll share a story with an investor who I sold an asset to, and it was performing at the time, and they bought it based on probably, I think it was 15% return, and it ends up going non-performing. And now it's an REO that they've taken back, and the property is probably worth a third of what they have in it. And they're going to lose some considerable money on this thing. Maybe they could possibly, my guess is, fix it up, put it as a rental, and then turn around, sell it and play the long game, or they could sell it and probably they're going to lose 10, 15 grand on this thing. And this was literally a $20,000 asset they bought. I think the UPB at the time was 28, 30. And, you know, after legal and everything, I think they're in it for like 25, and the place is worth less than that. So that can happen.
Yeah. And you're touching on, I mean, this is one of the key points of, I mean, it's one of the things I love about notes is there's collateral, right? It's like when you're buying an Amazon stock or whatever, there's no collateral. So that's why are you taking away that one of the key advantages to this alternative, I guess, asset class, the collateral? I mean, that's really important. I know it's exciting to go buy a note, but it's also really important to assume it's going to go south and really do your best to evaluate that property value.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I look at it from when I'm looking at assets right now, that's always the struggle is I would love to put some more performers in my portfolio because I love to have a mixed portfolio. And we got people who want some partials and so forth. But right now, I just tell them, I don't have anything because the stuff that I'm seeing right now is just overly priced. On the flip side, I'm picking up non-performing assets at prices still between 25, 50 cents on the dollar. And I view that as having lower risk, more work, but lower risk than picking up a performer at 95 cents on the dollar, if you can believe that.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and again, I think it depends on the situation for the individual investor too. You have a full-time job and you may not need that cash flow every month, but somebody starting out, they may want that cash flow, or maybe somebody who's retired, they're not looking to do all this work and get a big payday after 2 years. So yeah, it does depend on the personal situation as well.
You see pricing in your mind starting, especially on the performers, start to come back down to returns, what we've seen in the past where notes were around 12% and CFDs between 12 and 15. Do you see it coming back to that?
You know, nobody knows. I would guess it would go the opposite way. I mean, I know pricing has gone up, the yields have gone down on performers, but I'm not sure we're out of the woods here. So I do think the performing notes that remain performing in the next 1 to 2 years, in general are going to be valued that much higher. So I would actually say, at least for the next, again, predicting things is not a business you should necessarily be in, but I think the gap stays there or gets even wider between performing and non-performing. So if your performers remain performing, wouldn't you think they would have just as much value, if not more, you know, in the next 1 to 2 years?
Yeah, you'd think. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I have a dartboard literally right in front of me. And every time I think of something, it's like throwing a dart and trying to guess when you're trying to predict. And yeah, you're right. I think part of the challenge right now is we are in just such unprecedented times with so much going on in the world. So people look for something that is more stable, where I'll kind of take the opposite spectrum just to kind of bounce ideas back and forth against each other is what moratoriums like government-sponsored entities having foreclosures till the end of this year. We're starting to see foreclosure upticks. I think you're going to start seeing more assets on the market. So if you're starting to see more assets on the market, will that lead to lower pricing? And it's going to come back.
That's true. Yeah.
But the question comes back to, maybe you're still getting non-performers at lower pricing, but maybe those performers are staying higher returns, which if that's the case, then my strategy is going to be buy non-performers, get these things worked out and sell them in performing rates. If they're that high, then people can do very, very well if that's the case.
Yeah, that's a good point. I do think probably pricing of notes in general, both performers and non-performers, could come down because there's more supply, right? I bid on a tape this week, a few assets on a tape, and these are all in forbearance, and it could be 6 to 12 months that they're not paying. But these, the pricing expectations were that they're all high-end performers. And it's like, a lot of those are probably going to go non-performing. So in general, yeah, you're right. It may bring down the pricing of notes across the board. So we'll see.
Yeah, I just got 20 assets sent back to me last night that I can lock up today. And to give an idea, overall average is about 25 cents on the dollar, roughly. So yeah, I'm going to evaluate that today. We might be talking later, Jamie, if you
nice. Yeah, no, and I do think, I'll just real quick, I think you are mitigating a lot of that risk there. If you're, you know, people talk about in 2010, you could buy non-performers for 10 cents on the dollar, which I don't know if that's actually true. But let's say you end up buying this pool for 20 cents on the dollar. I mean, personally, I don't think we're going to see anything like we did 10 years ago. So how much lower can those non-performers go? Really, not much lower, I don't think.
Yeah. And one of the challenges is if I evaluate the sales price, that's based off UPB. But if I did the lower of the UPB to in value, the number's probably closer to about 45 cents on a dollar is my guess. Because for example, one asset's got a UPB over 400,000, the place is worth a little over 200. And you know, that one actually is probably closer to 60 cents on the dollar because it's in Florida, which $200,000 asset, and it's already in foreclosure. But other ones on here, I'm just looking, I see some that are 20, 30 cents on the dollar UPB, and they do have equity in them as well. So it'll be interesting. But, and that kind of lends to also, as part of pricing, buying in bulk versus buying one-offs. And typically, as you people start to grow, people need to have that expectation. Like we talk here, like I'm talking right now about 25, 40 cents on the dollar. And that's because, again, this is a buy of a few $100,000. If you're buying one asset from one person, you're not probably going to get that type of discount. You can still get it. I mean, I've got an asset right now on PaperStack that UPB's 20-something thousand. The property's worth 20-something thousand. I think I got it listed. I had it listed for $5,000 at one time, and people were coming back and offering me like two or three. So I just jacked the price up to $8,000 because if someone offers me $5,000 for it, they can have it. And it's just one that it's going to be foreclosure, or the person went dark and it's in one of my funds, and I'm starting to liquidate some of my non-performers in the funds because I'm going to be closing the fund in less than a year. So I'm slowly starting to liquidate those now. And you know, there's going to be opportunity. And I think you're going to see opportunity. But I see so many people ask me, hey, you got performers? And I'm like, yes, but I'm holding on to them right now. And I'm just trying to liquidate some of these non-performers because I believe with these performers, I won't have as much trouble liquidating them. So yeah, I think there's going to be that opportunity. And it goes back to that interesting perspective of everyone right now is looking for one thing. So should you be zigging when everyone's zagging, or vice versa?
Yeah, right. I guess that's that Warren Buffett quote about being fearful when others are greedy and greedy when others are fearful, right? So doing the opposite of what the crowd is doing. I wouldn't necessarily just say that's what you should always do. Sometimes there's a very good reason for what the crowd is doing. But yeah, it makes a lot of sense, Chris.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring up Buffett in that quote, because one of the things that I was taught through the corporate world was follow the big money and like the Buffetts, but follow what the big REITs are doing in some of these other firms, because the number of analysts and people they have studying markets is just insane. And when you see a lot of these REITs selling a lot of their properties for 4, 5, 6 cap, and they're making so much money off it, and they've just got a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines, that's kind of a predictor of things to come as well, I think, where you got a lot of other investors buying right now. And if you got REITs, and I'm talking more on the commercial side of things and multifamily, they're selling them. And I would too. If I had multifamily and someone offered me a 4 or 5 cap, I'd sell it right now and kind of just wait and see what's going on, especially right now where people are still paying rent. But I think there's going to be a lot of laws coming out in that function. But I also think there's laws coming out with note investing, which we've just seen in California, where people, it's going to become a lot more license-based from that perspective. So I think we're kind of shifting a little focus of getting on to staying ahead of the curve for those types of things. But it kind of ties into what we're talking about, because it's all about risk. And that's really one of the things people need to look at is risk. So Jamie, for you, what are you looking at for performers? What do you see and what is your target? You know, example, I'm seeing stuff at 8 to 10% and from the common sources, like some of these servicers and other sites that sell. What are your thoughts? What are you seeing and what are you trying to target?
The pricing expectations I've seen on tapes has been right in that ballpark, 8-9% even. We just bought the 2 pretty strong performers in Florida that were more in the 11% range. It's just funny because last year, 12 months ago, I probably would have said, oh, that's too expensive, but I'm okay taking a little bit of a hit as compared to where we were, if that's just where the market is. So we've lowered our pricing expectations on performers. When I started in the note space, it was more 12 to 15% as far as your yield, especially on the kind of under $50,000 UPB, maybe CFDs. I think that's come down to 10 to 12% for those type assets. And then the higher equity, higher dollar notes, it's more in the 8 to 10% range. So I'm trying to, honestly, to be more direct, anything 10 to 12% that's equity protected is what I'm looking for. Specifically, as far as geography, I mean, we recently got licensed in Georgia, as you know. So I'm kind of heavily focused myself on the Southeast, Georgia and Florida, since we do have some good boots on the ground down there with attorneys and property management companies. So yeah, pricing has come down, but that's kind of our buy box right now, if you will.
Yeah, I'm seeing the same things, 8 to 10. I still target 12 or higher. But one of the things that we haven't touched upon and we really need to talk about is what the hell is a performing note? Person was paying pre-COVID, haven't paid in 6 months, so it's a performer. No, yeah. It's not.
We originated this seller finance note 3 weeks ago. First payment is next month. Performer. I don't get that at all. So
person signed a mod in April, made 3 out of 6 payments. Ding, ding. Like it's got the performer rubber stamp on it. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Right.
So let's educate people, because I think that's something that's important as well, because some people may be like, okay, I'm happy paying 10% for a performing note, especially getting started, but is it really a performing note?
Is it actually a performer? Right. Absolutely.
So what's your definition?
Yeah, I would say 10 to 12 months of on time or close to on time payments in the last 12 months, something like that. 6 months is just not long enough. Does it have to actually be on time? I'm okay if they were late a couple times, but I'd say 10 to 12 payments in the last 12 months, and certainly not more than 60 days behind at any point during that 12 months.
Yeah. So for me, I look at it, same thing. I mean, if the payment's due on the 1st, they make payment on the 10th or the 17th. If they're making payments every month,
yeah,
I'm fine with that.
That's fine.
Typically, I like to look at the past year, go back a year, because like you said, things can happen during that time. And if they've missed a payment during the year, I'd probably still consider it performer. 2, I'm starting to discount it. If it's more than 2, then I'm really starting to discount it. Not maybe full non-performing, but it's getting discounted further. Maybe instead of if I was targeting 14%, maybe I'm going to target 17%, because I'm basing it on of, you know, I'm running my calculator of, okay, instead of getting 12 payments, I'm probably only going to get 10. So what does that look like in your calculator? So some of the things that you look at from that perspective are those cases. Now, I know people on the flip side, so I'm going to ask you this question. Someone misses 2 months and pays every 3 months, but they pay all 3 months during that time, performer or non-performer.
So you're talking they pay every 3 months in general, but they get caught up. I'm putting that more in the sub-performer, non-performer category. Those can be so much, they can be just as much work as a non-performer. Yes, the person is paid up, they're caught up, but it's just not the same as a monthly payment.
And here's the other reason why I put that in non-performer bucket. What's your servicer charging you? It drives you nuts.
Yeah, that's true.
Like they're charging, you're getting charged $90 a month or whatever it is because this jackass pays every 3 months. And it frustrates the heck. And when I see that, I typically will, I'll bid it more as a non-performer and I'll be like, and this is the stuff that I enjoy talking about on the podcast because there's nowhere, nobody talks about this in any type of training of how do you evaluate something like this? I mean, this is the gray area of note investing that you need to kind of think of all the ramifications.
Yeah, absolutely. I can speak for how we price things. I mean, I have a performing calculator that was yours, Chris, on your website, your freebies. And that's what I use for performing pricing. And then I have another tool that I use, another calculator that I use for non-performers. So in that sense, I do approach all assets as either non-performing or performing, but there's so much gray like you're touching on. And I've bought several this year that are more in the sub-performer category. Personally, I haven't bought anything that's some of the stuff that you're not afraid of. I haven't gone near where there hasn't been a payment in the last few years. I do like that sub-performing space where they're paying, there's communication, there's contact with the borrower, there's clearly interest that they want to stay in the property and that kind of thing, but they're 2 or 3 years behind with recent payments though. So as far as pricing, I'll actually just run it through both calculators and just kind of see what we come up with. It's certainly not a performer, but I wouldn't necessarily price it as a full non-performer if they're making payments every month. So there is a lot of gray, and I just think some of it, approaching pricing kind of comes with experience and kind of figuring out what you're targeting.
Yeah, because I could argue right now that I would rather buy a note where the person has been making several payments and they're 3 years behind than somebody who's technically current but paying like every 3 months. And I would argue all day long that the one 3 years behind, but they're making some payments, is much more valuable than the other one. And people are probably scratching their head like, what are you talking about? And I'll do a case study at some point in time on it to explain why. But there's reasons that that would take a whole episode to discuss from that perspective.
Yeah, but you're right about the servicing costs. I mean, that is something people overlook. I mean, I think Madison, for example, and I get why they do this. I'm not knocking this, but I think they have to see 3 on-time payments before they'll switch it from non-performing to performing. And that's a substantial difference in cost to the investor. So, and the other thing is not just servicing costs, legal. I mean, I've had several where someone's paying, like you're talking about, every few months. We start to get legal going, we send a demand letter, and now boom, they reinstate. And it's like, you can put those legal costs as part of the payoff, but there's so much work involved and so much communication with your attorney and actual costs involved. I agree with you. That's more of a non-performer.
Okay. So I think we've kind of talked a good amount today about the where we should go, performers and non-performers. What is a performer? It's always good to have these conversations because the reality is this stuff changes. A conversation we had 6 months ago, we may have done an episode on, is different than it is today. And it's important to constantly keep people up to date and up to speed on things. So why don't we roll into our final segment? You have your note and bolt for today.
Why don't you go first?
Okay. So one of the things that I look at in performing assets and for my note and bolt tip is if you haven't seen the entire pay history yet, or you just got it, but you haven't seen the servicing notes, one of the things I look at is the date they paid. And if they're paying the same date every month or it fluctuates by like a day, there's a pretty good chance that they're paying by ACH. And I've always, in my research, in my past history, I found the people who are on ACH are much consistent payers than the people who mail in the checks every month because life happens and people forget to mail it or whatever happens. But when it's on ACH, which is automated to come out on a certain day every month, I see a lot more consistency in those. And I also think they probably should be worth a little more. So that's something that, like, when you're on websites and somebody may put a newspaper stack as an example, and somebody puts in the pay history there, and you see on the second of every month that that payment's coming out or it's been paid on that day, probably a good chance that that's on ACH. So as you go to start doing some of your more due diligence or you get an offer accepted, you can confirm it. But it's just a tip that I look at sometimes when they provide the dates or the pay history upfront, give you an idea of how they're paying.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think my note and bolt is going to be more targeting kind of brand new investors and doesn't only apply to note investing, but see where you can add value. That's my tip, is just you see people in these Facebook groups kind of posting, how do I do this? How do I price a non-performer? What's your due diligence checklist? And don't get me wrong, I've learned a ton from you, Chris, and from a lot of other more experienced investors. And I certainly take that knowledge and try to apply it. So I don't want to act like I don't receive help from others. But if you're brand new starting out, figure out where you can offer value to a more senior investor, or it's all about solving problems for people. So I would say just don't approach this knowledge seeking journey as just a gimme, gimme, gimme. It's what can you offer? And then you'll get something back in return. So that's my note and bolt.
Here, and I'll add on to that a little bit, because again, coming from the corporate world, the rule of thumb is anytime you go to a superior with a problem, you should have the solution in hand or an idea. You just don't go and
Some options.
Yeah. And I kind of relay this a little bit to note investing when you're learning is, I think we're on the same page, someone posts, what states you like to invest in? So, I mean, that's so open-ended, and I'm like, hey, I like Maryland because of, I got boots on the ground. That might not fit you, and you might be in Cleveland, you might live in Cleveland and be like, hey, I like Cleveland because I live there. But the thing I would say is, instead of asking that question, ask the question, hey, I was looking on Bigger Pockets on Facebook group, and I see a lot of people like Florida, and I know that it's a judicial state. Why do people like Florida? Now, if somebody asked that question as a newbie, I would be like, the person did their research, the person did some background on it, that person wants to learn. And I would have so much more respect for that person.
Absolutely. And also just kind of read through the previous forums. And it's not to say, like, I don't want to come across, don't ever ask me a question, read all my blog posts first before you speak to me. It's not like that. But if there was a recent post in the forum about this particular topic, maybe go check that out first. And like you're saying, show that you've done some work, is really show that you're willing to put in some effort. And I mean, I feel like this is like parenting or something.
Well, it's interesting too, because one of the things I looked at literally last night, and I posted this in the group, was about Facebook. And we have the Facebook group, and you know, I've got 1,200 members in there, but Facebook groups, there's no way to segregate any of the information. And so I've been looking at sites like Money Network, Circle SO, Tribe SO, which are more community platforms that you can break things down, kind of like, I'll say, a Bigger Pockets, but for note investing, where, hey, you know, there's a discussion on due diligence, there's a discussion on forced place insurance. And I'm looking at it like that would be, I think, very beneficial. But in the same token, like, I know a lot of people, you know, are stuck on Facebook and stuff, and you know, it's easy because you just go to Facebook to check something. But, and I go back and forth on this, just because I have 1,200 people in the group doesn't mean that many are active. And if it's a place where people really want to go learn, then if they don't want to take the two minutes to go to somewhere else besides Facebook, then they're not really seeking to be educated in that sense.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's probably okay to have both options. I mean, I think what you're talking about is moving more towards to me, I'm hearing quality versus quantity. Yeah, you might have a lot of members in the group, but are they all active and really interested? So I can speak personally. I took Facebook off my phone a couple of years ago. I was close to getting off of Facebook. It really was note groups that kept me on. And I only go to note groups on Facebook, but I'm absolutely more interested in something that's more organized, and I'd be happy to get away from Facebook myself.
Yeah. I mean, for me, Facebook, I use it for basically the note group and notes and bolts. I mean, I'm in other groups, but I'm not super active in them just because sometimes I get overboard and try and take things over. But I use it also, for example, you know, I want to buy a piece of property in a specific location. So I'm a part of a group in that area. I am interested in learning about a certain topic. So I'm in a group for that, as an example. From a friendship perspective, my friends on Facebook basically is few and far in between. And I'll be honest, most note investors I'm not friends with, because I started friending some of them. And then I see them posting all this political stuff. And I'm like, you know what? I don't need to deal with this. I mean, I'm seeing it now on LinkedIn with political stuff. And I'm like, come on.
I know. Right. Nothing sacred anymore.
So, well, we're going to wrap up this episode of the Good Deeds Note Investing podcast. As always, you know, you can find us on every platform out there, basically iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, iHeart, Amazon. I'm actually announced some numbers in the upcoming weeks that I was pumped about that I saw yesterday that I forwarded to you. So keep that secret right now, but we'll be announcing that because things have been really going well for Good Deeds Note Investing podcast. So, Jamie, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And if anybody does have needs help with anything, feel free to reach out. I don't want to come across like I'm not here to help. Definitely am. And yeah, go Ravens.
Thank you all.
Thanks for tuning in to the Good Deeds Note Investing podcast. If you like what you just heard, feel free to share us with your friends and colleagues, as well as drop by iTunes and leave a rating or comment. You can visit our website at www.gooddeedsnoteinvesting.com to sign up for email updates for future shows and access all of our great content, including show transcripts, case studies, video tutorials, and more. Don't forget to join us next time for another episode on building your wealth and making a difference.